This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, President Donald Trump travels to Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Europe for his first overseas trip since assuming office. Hello again. I'm Carol Castiel. Exactly 1 year ago, Mr. Trump's predecessor, Barack Obama, was in Saudi Arabia. But the difference between how the Saudi monarchy received him and Donald Trump could not have been starker. Former President Barack Obama earned the Saudis' ire for negotiating a nuclear agreement with their rival Iran and seeking closer relations with the Islamic Republic. In contrast, President Trump was warmly received by the Saudi monarchy and by dozens of other leaders from across the Muslim world. Mr. Trump's decision to visit Saudi Arabia and Israel before other countries and his warm rhetoric for their leadership signals a shift away from Mr. Obama's policy in the region, which Mr. Trump has blamed for the turmoil there.
I stand before you as a representative of the American people to deliver a message of friendship and hope and love. That is why I chose to make my first foreign visit a trip to the heart of the Muslim world, to the nation that serves as custodian of the two holiest sites in the Islamic faith.
In his address in the Saudi capital Riyadh on May 21st, President Donald Trump pivoted away from his strident depiction of Islam as a religion of hatred, as he characterized it during his presidential election campaign. He sought to revive the traditional U.S. alliance with Sunni Arab states, even as Tehran exerts its dominance by supporting militants in Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. Coincidentally, that same week, Iran held elections and re-elected President Hassan Rouhani, seen as the more so-called moderate candidate. But he nonetheless defers to the hardline supreme leader and guardian council on such regional matters. In his wide-ranging address, Donald Trump underscored the need to confront the crisis of Islamist extremism and the Islamist terrorist groups it inspires, and of course, to isolate Iran.
Starving terrorists of their territory, of their funding, and the false allure of the craven ideology will be the basis for easily defeating them. But no discussion of stamping out this threat would be complete without mentioning the government that gives terrorists all three: safe harbor, financial backing, and the social standing needed for recruitment. It is a regime that is responsible for so much instability in that region. I am speaking, of course, of Iran.
President Donald Trump speaking in Riyadh. Well, arriving in Tel Aviv, Trump declared he saw the possibility of a new alignment of Muslim nations and Israel against a shared foe, Iran. But to the dismay of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his hardline government, Mr. Trump went further by trying to tie the future of the anti-Iran coalition to the Palestinian issue. Mr. Trump would like to be the one American leader to broker a definitive peace deal between Israelis and Palestinians. Mutually beneficial business deals also figured in the trip, reminding everyone of Mr. Trump's America First philosophy. The United States and Saudi Arabia agreed to a $109 billion arms package and a further $300 billion in other deals and potential investments.
Yesterday, we signed historic agreements with the kingdom that will invest almost $400 billion in our two countries and create many hundreds of thousands of jobs in America and Saudi Arabia. This landmark agreement includes the announcement of a $110 billion Saudi-funded defense purchase, and we will be sure to help our Saudi friends to get a good deal from our great American defense companies, the greatest anywhere in the world.
Speaking of security, a new global center for combating extremist ideology was also inaugurated in Riyadh. Mr. Trump went on to meet the Pope at the Vatican, attend a NATO summit in Brussels, and a G7 summit in Italy. European leaders were visibly unsettled in Brussels on Thursday after President Trump declined to explicitly endorse NATO's mutual defense pledge and lashed out over what he called, quote, chronic underpayments, unquote. Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations and former head of policy planning at the State Department, could not help but notice a marked contrast between Mr. Trump's public lecturing of NATO allies and what was perceived of as a, quote, overly solicitous treatment of the Saudis, unquote. Well, for a readout on President Trump's first overseas trip are two distinguished foreign policy analysts. Hussein Ibish is a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, and that's a think tank here in Washington. Ibish is also a frequent contributor to Foreign Policy Magazine and The Atlantic, and is a columnist for the UAE newspaper The National. And Perry Kamak, he was previously an aide to former Secretary of State John Kerry, now fellow in the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and that's a policy group also based in Washington. Both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Carol.
And I'm not sure if you recall, but 1 year ago, you were both here at these microphones to discuss none other than President Obama's trip to this very region. Starting with you, Hussein Ibish, quite a study in contrast, to say the least.
Indeed.
What's your brief assessment of the tone and substance of this trip?
Well, I think that the shifts from Obama are largely thematic and kind of developing. I don't think the president has a fully integrated, coherent Middle East policy of his own yet. So a lot of this is a continuation of what you had under Obama in terms of, say, counterterrorism and that sort of stuff is just continued or intensified. There is a renewed emphasis on rebuilding partnerships with traditional allies like the Sunni Gulf Arab States and Israel, repairing frayed nerves that emerged under Obama and taking a tougher line with Iran. So all of that's there, a renewed emphasis on a transactional nature and sort of commerce and how much are you going to pay me and how much are you going to buy of what I want to sell. Now that's a little different from Obama, but I think if you strip it down, a lot of this is optics, and a great deal of policy is the same. For example, in the criticism of sort of embracing of autocratic leaders, well, most of those autocratic leaders aren't getting that much more out of the United States. I think the Saudis might be an exception, but say that the Turkish leader or the Egyptian leader and things like that are not getting any additional support from the United States they didn't get under Obama. They're getting a different political atmosphere and different optics. But I think the continuities are still stronger than the divergences because interests haven't changed.
To you, Perry Kamak, do you see that the policy is essentially the same? The optics have changed, perhaps some language different, but essentially a sense of coherency?
I largely agree with Hussein, but with a couple of distinctions, which I'll explain. So first, I mean, the obvious has to be stated that it's hard to imagine two American presidents more different kind of in terms of their rhetoric and temperament than Barack Obama and Donald Trump. And I think we saw that play out during the trip. Looking at the trip, which I think is also kind of some prism into the Trump administration's foreign policy, I would kind of divide it into two halves. The first half being the Middle East visit, in which I actually completely agree with Hussein that the rhetoric is quite different, but they're actually is quite a bit of continuity. You know, there is an effort to bring the Saudis a little bit more on board, ongoing effort to isolate Iran, but I think that the evolutions are more in the margins. However, when we flip to the second part of the trip in Europe and with NATO there, I see actually quite a big difference between Obama and Trump. And we have a president that really is kind of questioning what underpins essentially the transatlantic alliance, which has been the core kind of U.S. strategic military partnership really over the last 70 years. And if I could say one more thing quickly, I think we also can't really understand what happened with the Trump visit over the last week without the political context, which is potentially existential political crisis here in Washington.
And that's my next question. So back to you, Hussein Ibish. To what extent do you think Mr. Trump's troubles at home, the controversy over firing FBI Director James Comey, the naming of a special counsel, Robert Mueller, to what extent did these events and others overshadow the trip?
Well, I think you couldn't get away from it. He flew into sunny Saudi Arabia with the darkest clouds Washington has produced in a while looming over him, and everybody knows this. At the same time, by the way, he was presenting himself as the anti-Obama. He's sort of saying, everything that Obama did, I'm going to do the opposite. Everywhere he didn't go, I'm going to go first, and that kind of stuff. There was a lot of theatricality about that. Now, everyone sort of knows that there's a set of political controversies and potential scandals looming over the administration, and also a high degree of dysfunctionality in the administration, a State Department that's demoralized, an administrative apparatus that is not fully staffed at the second and third tier level, right underneath the cabinet. So I think people are aware of this. For the Saudis and the Israelis, they're putting that aside and they're focusing on the re-embrace and making the best of it. And it really is an important opportunity for them, especially especially in the Gulf. You know, it's very hard to find too much daylight between some of these countries and the Trump administration's attitudes. There's virtually none at all between Trump and the UAE, very little between Trump and Saudi Arabia. So what's not to like? Even stylistically, they see similarities. And no, I won't go through it all. But at the same time, I do think that when it comes to, you know, his attitude in, say, in Europe, it's been a real problem. And it does definitely loom and color a lot of what, you know, he's trying to do. And sort of, it's cloud.
Indeed. Well, we're going to get to the European part, but first let me get Perry Kamak to respond to the question that you projected, which is, to what extent did Mr. Trump's troubles here at home with the Comey firing and the investigations cloud his trip?
You know, I have to say, in terms of the optics, in terms of the stage management, I think the first three stops, essentially, which would be Saudi Arabia, Israel, the Vatican, were actually managed pretty well. So I think that actually was an important accomplishment. It's hard to get things done, as you know, Carol, in the Middle East. These were relationships that had frayed. And so I think the fact that he had successful visits in Saudi Arabia and Israel in the short term are quite important. I personally am of the view that there is a bit of longer term drift between kind of U.S. strategic interests in the Middle East and those of either Gulf and Israel. So, you know, is it short-lived? Is it a photo op? Is it ephemeral? Or has there really been a kind of strategic shift in U.S. policy toward the Middle East? I'm a little bit skeptical that it's the latter, actually.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Hussein Ibish, senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, and Perry Kamak, from whom you just heard. He's an associate in the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, both work at think tanks based here in Washington, and we are discussing the impact of President Donald Trump's recent diplomatic tour in the Middle East and Europe. Well, this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Now, here's a shout out to Ndao Koti Courageux. He's a loyal listener from Bujumbura, Burundi. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Hussein Ibish. Let's talk a little bit more about the Middle East, particularly Mr. Trump's visit in Israel. You know, he's saying that I'm going to be able to make a deal. He believes that he can bring Israelis and Palestinians together. He sees the common enemy between many of the Sunni Gulf states, particularly Saudi Arabia and Israel. He thinks that that common enemy somehow is going to bring them together over this Palestinian issue. What are your thoughts?
Well, this thing is called outside-in approach. That's the shorthand for it. It's the first interesting and barely plausible idea that anybody's had for years, at least since the Salam Fayyad bottom-up approach that kind of was strangled by everybody else. But it's the first good idea that anyone's had in a while. And theoretically, it should work because it could be a win-win-win for Israel, the Arab states, and the Palestinians in the sense that the Israelis and the Arab countries want to, you know, have a strategic interest and would like to cooperate much more on building a common front against Iran. But the Palestinian issue stands between them. So the idea is somehow you bring in the Arabs into this mix, you incentivize the Israelis, you know, to make an interim agreement, not a final status agreement, something more modest with the Palestinians in order to get closer to the Arabs and allow them politically to do that. And the Arabs can provide the Palestinians with diplomatic support and political cover and economic aid to make it, you know, these concessions they would have to make, and the fact that they'd have to accept something interim and partial, acceptable. The problem is that there are huge political obstacles on all sides to this, especially for Prime Minister Netanyahu, who doesn't really feel the need to take much risk. And I think the biggest problem is the Israelis feel that they have toughed things out for decades, and the price has gone very low now. It used to be, you know, withdraw from the occupied territories. Then it was, well, make a deal with the Palestinians. Now it's, let's have a process and some kind of interim arrangement. And I think they're saying to themselves, look, if we just tough it out for another decade or two, the price will go to virtually zero. That's a mistake, but I think it's easy politically to think that and say that.
So turning to you, Perry Kamak, on this very point, Mr. Trump has touted the fact that he thinks he can make the ultimate deal to try to get a two-state solution, thinking that at this point, the Israelis and the Saudis and many other Arab states, you know, have this common enemy in Iran, and that somehow the Palestinian issue could be overcome as a result of that. What are your thoughts?
I think Hussein put it quite well, that you can imagine a kind of theoretical construct in which it works, but I do think the politics, frankly, on all sides mitigate against it. But to me, there's another concern I have with this kind of idea of a kind of unified front against terrorism. And the fact that it's against Iran, which, you know, on one hand, it's understandable. Iran is certainly a bad actor. It supports kind of obstructionist groups, terrorist groups, undermines Arab states around the region. But what I worry is that that pushes us closer to confrontation, particularly in a place like Yemen, which is already a humanitarian catastrophe from my perspective. And I worry if a means of this is kind of doubling down on the Saudi misadventure in Yemen, things could go very, very south in a way that has really catastrophic humanitarian consequences, and which frankly actually empowers Iran in Yemen, has already strengthened al-Qaeda in Yemen. So to me, that's the place where I'm looking for in terms of, it's one thing to say theoretically we have unity, but how does it play out in terms of these internal conflicts in Yemen and Syria and Iraq?
You wanted to add something.
Yeah, I mean, I think your concerns about Yemen are reasonable, but I think Syria is the counterexample. Syria is an incredible humanitarian disaster on a much exponentially bigger scale than Yemen, and that's down to Iran, and down to Iran and Russia and Hezbollah having a free hand. And I think you could posit that while this might make the situation worse in Yemen, it's actually likely to be a stabilizing force in Syria. That some kind of balancing in Syria would really help to stabilize things there, in my view.
Interestingly, this is another point on which the Israelis and many of the Gulf Arab states have something in common, because they see Bashar al-Assad, who is backed by Russia and backed by Iran, as the more lethal enemy compared to the Islamic State.
Well, and more than that, there's and al-Qaeda, by the way, which I think is a bigger danger in Syria in the long run than the Islamic State. But there's a specific thing. Iran is trying to create a land corridor from the Iranian border to the Mediterranean Sea, either through
the
south.
Well, it has it essentially already.
Yes, but they want to make it permanent, and they want to have it totally under their control, their and Hezbollah's control, without relying on the Syrian regime. They want to essentially have a colonial concession of this kind of corridor, which would, it's a game changer if they can secure this and make it permanent or semi-permanent. That's something that I think not only the Arabs can't live with, the Israelis can't live with it, and I don't think anyone can live with it, frankly. I think it would be a very helpful thing in most contexts. I agree with you in a place like Yemen and a few other cases. That, and also our, to some extent, exaggerated rhetoric. I mean, we might be talking ourselves into confrontations that are avoidable. But overall, the idea of a new strategic environment is a good one.
Well, I think an irony, too, Perry Kamak, is the fact that the Center for Combating Extremism, which was inaugurated in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, some see a bit of irony there, because some also blame the Wahhabi doctrine that emanates from Saudi Arabia, this very fundamentalist view of Islam. They see that as a basis for some of the beliefs and ideology of the Islamic State or other extremist groups. So
I think that is true. It's certainly part of the Saudi legacy of, say, the last half century. I will say, as someone who has some experience in government, that actually Saudi Arabia has made quite a bit of progress, and important progress, technical progress on this issue. Actually, and the laggards really at this point are some of the other smaller Gulf states, some of the other GCC states.
Such as?
Kuwait and Qatar would be two that I would kind of name. And so I actually think there is some possibility here that there's a demonstration effect. There's some pressure that, you know, this is a small, fairly modest in the scheme of the problems of the Middle East. But I do think this center, over time, if it's invested, you know, with real assets and people, that it could have some modest impact, you know, less in Saudi Arabia and more, I would say, in some of the other GCC states.
Saudis are genuinely concerned about this. They're threatened. The Saudi government is threatened by this. It's their Frankenstein's monster to some extent, at least ideologically, not institutionally, but in terms of some of the ideas, that's true. But things like this gesture are essential if it's going to be dealt with.
Well, Hussein Ibish, as we close, we need to talk about the European part of the trip.
No.
President Trump's speech to NATO allies in Brussels. There was a lot of discomfort there, and you alluded to that in answer to a previous question.
Well, this is where the trip dovetails with the domestic woes in a really unnerving way, because not only did President Trump not acknowledge the existence of Article 5, which is the mutual defense commitment in NATO, he made some oblique reference to those who supported us on 9/11, which might be referring to NATO or might not. I mean, it's really kind of too vague. It didn't satisfy anybody. And by all accounts, there was a huge rift between President Trump and everybody else over Russia. And there is this huge mystery about why Mr. Trump alone, not only internationally, but even within his administration, can't let go of the idea that Russia is a good actor, that Russia is a potential ally, that there's something to do. And it brings back, again, people, rationally or not, reasonably or not, to the question, what's the nature of the real relationship between him as an individual, his campaign, his political rise to the Russian government and Russian interests?
Turning to you, Perry Kamak, for your assessment of President Trump's address to NATO allies, and to what extent do you think that, notwithstanding the fact that he has already said NATO is important, he backed off rhetoric about NATO being obsolete, but what about the fact that he questioned or hasn't made a vigorous endorsement of Article 5, and then this rift over Russia?
So some of this, I think, is overplayed a little bit, in the sense that I think 6 months from now or a year from now, I'm not sure we're going to look back at that particular speech as really being significant in the terms of the Trump administration policy or approach to Europe. But what it is, I think, is an important indicator of where things are and where things are going and where things are likely to be. Now, the good news, I think, is that these are very robust and resilient relationships economically, culturally, politically, diplomatically, in terms of intel, security, militarily, etc. But it's very clear that there is going to be pressure from the top that is going to be persistent, and it's at times, I think, going to be pretty intense. And so for me, the question is not where we are in 2017, but where does that trajectory take us, say, in 3 or 4 years?
Well, back to you, Hussein Ibish. For any thoughts regarding the EU summit in Italy, the optics, the tone, the substance?
Well, again, it's the same set of problems. In a sense, I think the skepticism that seemed to follow President Trump to NATO followed him to the EU. Is it healthy for American foreign policy? Is it an overcorrection? Does it do damage to U.S. interests in the long run by squandering American credibility, longstanding alliances, institutions that Perry referred to that have been built painstakingly over decades and are now being at least chipped away at? And behind that is, again and again, why would you be playing into the hands of Putin's agenda? Because that's what it looks like.
Well, the last word to you, Perry Kamak. Again, we come back to the intersection between domestic politics and foreign policy with the Russia question, but also any thoughts vis-a-vis the European allies. And we also note that just during the week that President Trump was overseas, his official budget came out and there were huge cuts. Mm. We knew about that, to State Department, to USAID. So these are tools for diplomacy. Mm.
You know, I think sometimes when we have these conversations, particularly in Washington, it can become kind of an academic discussion of foreign policy, which is perhaps, you know, detached a bit from the daily lives of some of your listeners. But, you know, some of the things we're talking about in the U.S.-European relationship, anything that the United States is trying to do, whether it's on kind of global governance, whether it's on counterterrorism, whether it's on kind of protecting the fidelity of cyber data, whether it's climate change, economic institutions, all of these, or many of these, are premised on this kind of transatlantic partnership. As Hussein says, to the extent you're chipping away at that, you're chipping away at the American instruments of diplomacy that can kind of help advance those interests. That's hurting America, as far as I'm concerned.
It also puts the country in a position of having to potentially fight more conflicts, longer, more devastating conflicts, with less potential for good post-conflict resolution and stabilization. It just weakens the whole ability of the United States to conduct its foreign policy. And I think one of the biggest oppositions to this idea is going to come from uniformed military, if anybody listens to them.
I agree.
All right. Well, on that point of agreement, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Hussein Ibish, he's senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, and Perry Kamak, he's associate in the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your terrific insights.
Thanks so much, Carol.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Joe Gill. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter. on the Voice of America.